Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi there, my name is Thomas Buff. I'm the editor of wolvesblog.com, website dedicated entirely to Wolverhampton Wanderers Football Club. You can find us there, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, now X, at wolvesblog.
Hi, I'm Steve McGugan, a Spurs fan based in Belfast, so happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone listening. And in a previous life, I used to be the chairman of the New York Spurs Supporters Club.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining me today, guys. I did notice as I was scheduling folks for this show that I think this is the third straight show for the two of you that you've been on together. Obviously not the last three total shows, but just an odd scheduling quirk. But thanks for coming on as ever. I figure we should start off by talking about the FA Cup quarterfinal. I've already seen some people referring to it as the best quarterfinal weekend that they can really remember. So I just wanted to start with that. Were you particularly impressed by this round of matches?
Yeah, I mean, it was a superb set of games. As I said off air, probably the exception to the rule was the Manchester City game. You know, two deflected goals probably took the sting out of that tie. It made it very difficult for Newcastle to really do anything in that game. But the other game, obviously, Wolves' defeat to Coventry, that was superb. Wolves taking the lead, Coventry turning it round. You know, great underdog story for them. A punch to the solar plexus for me. But, you know, those are the breaks. But you can't deny it was a superb game. And then following on today, Chelsea seemingly easing through against Leicester. And then, you know, you turn your back on it for a second and suddenly Leicester are back in it. And, you know, it takes another surge from Chelsea to go over the line. And then Man United, Liverpool, you know, fantastic end-to-end game. So I can't really remember in the cup competitions a sequence of games so memorable. Three out of the four very, very good games. Normally with the FA Cup at that stage, it's kind of what I always tend to think is it's just like what happens mostly is the teams that you expect to progress and the games are a little bit more measured because teams are just kind of managing their resources this close to the end of the season. So it was good to have, kind of up and at 'em games where it was on, everyone was on the front foot trying to do something. And superb, you know, and all the ingredients of a great FA Cup competition are still there. You've got an underdog in the semi-final in Coventry. You're getting big teams knocked out like Liverpool, and then you've got Chelsea, Man City, and even you know on the other side in the semi-final draw. So you know Chelsea, a weird side. They've got every chance as they showed when they went to the Etihad a few weeks ago. They'll give Man City a good run for their money, I'm confident, in the semi-final. And then on the other side, Coventry against a Man United side that you would fancy. But Coventry, you know, will feel that maybe they can catch Man United on an off day and do something. So, yeah, I mean, there's no reason that the semi-finals can't be quite decent as well. But you would obviously expect from there probably a Manchester derby for the final. But yeah, very, very good in the quarterfinals and hopefully the semi-finals will be just as good.
Yeah, I totally agree with all of that. I mean, we were talking also before we went on air about bringing the semi-finals back to a neutral ground, which I think would be a wonderful development again. But yeah, I mean, everything about, as you said, Thomas, everything about those four games gave you something unexpected and exciting, and commiserations on your going out at that stage. You're right also about the Man City Newcastle game. That was it just sort of reinforced Man City's inevitability, really, just generally. So I'm all against anything that reinforces Man City's inevitability, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, this was the Man United Liverpool game was just, that's why we love football, for goodness sake. It was just a great game for the neutral. You thought as you were watching it that Liverpool would end up ruining their wastefulness in a second half that they completely dominated but failed to put the game to bed. And we'd seen that so many times with our own teams, you know. But just absolutely great, great entertainment. And it helps to revive the image of the FA Cup a little bit as well. It had sort of gone off the boil for a few years. But it also serves to remind us of how Spurs will rue not having a cup run this year and really how much the fans miss that sort of excitement. Mm. But no, I was very, very, very taken with all four games this weekend.
Yeah, definitely a good one for the neutral. Maybe a little bit less so if you had a club in it. But of course, we'll circle back to the Wolves match later in the show. Next, I wanted to talk about something that happened in the Tottenham pre-match press conference with Ange Postecoglou, where he was posed a question in what seemed a bit of a biased way about traveling fans, in which they were referred to as tourists or plastic. Obviously, this is a sensitive might be too strong a word, but it's an issue that I'm sensitive to as a foreign fan, because of course I am one of these people that will fly over whenever I can, obviously would pay whatever ticket price required to be able to see them in my one opportunity to see them a year, while also recognizing that I have many friends like the two of you who are able to go far more frequently and are used to much lower ticket prices. And stuff like that. So rather than just being like, wow, what a stupid question, what a great response by Ange, which did seem to be some of the social media reactions to all this, I was wondering if you think there has been like a direct relationship between global appeal and things like increasing ticket prices or a change in match day atmosphere and stuff like that. And if you have ideas on it, how it could be kind of put back together as a fact that it is both a global game. Basically, every Premier League club now has global fans, but also still making sure that it is still affordable and a good time out for the people that live more locally.
Yeah, I can only really comment from a Wolves perspective and what I've perceived and seen. And we're probably not one of the teams, because we haven't got one of these 50, 60,000 mega stadiums where they've got giant hospitality areas and then more tickets probably become available to third-party sites that can resell and things like that. So we probably don't see it as much. But what I would say is this has probably been the first season where I've really noticed a lot of fans, and they're quite easy to notice because they're all South Koreans, because they're all coming to see Wang Ki-chan. And it's become a thing on the social media because, you know, after the game, he's got a line of like 100 people waiting to, you know, get their photos with him and him to sign everything. And after every game, he's out there and he meets every single one of them, you know, massive credit to him for doing that. But, you know, it is different and you notice it. But what I would say is I haven't personally really been hyper aware of any change in atmosphere or any you know, major changes to how it feels to go to a game for Wolves. And if there have been changes, then I think they're largely positive, because I just think it feels a little bit more inclusive, and it feels like that it's not some of the kind of nastiness maybe has just gone out of it a little bit. But I still think the ingredients that make watching live football brilliant are still all there. You know, it is still very tribal. It still does feel like it's that gladiatorial kind of atmosphere, the home end, the away end, you know, because you still have that nucleus of the real kind of the people who go absolutely every week and live and die for it. They're always going to find a way to go because, you know, they just absolutely love it. But then again, I suppose you would have to say that on the rules of supply and demand, if there are lots of people who are, you know, they're freeing up tickets there, for other people to come, is, you know, football tourists, if you want to call them that, or whatever, who are coming to one-off games, then obviously if there's a greater demand, then it is going to squeeze the price up. But that to me is just the way that football is going generally. It's just a more commercial, it's a commercialized sport, and you can't halt it. You know, everything in life is evolving all the time. You just have to accept that. You can't just bottle it. You know, you can't bottle it and keep the football match day experience the same as it was in the 80s and 90s forever, because everything is changing. So I just accept it as it is. I mean, I can't speak. I know there will be people who say, maybe, you know, I used to go down and I've been priced out of it. And that's probably the case for certain people. I think particularly if you support certain clubs, you know, probably Tottenham are probably an example, I would imagine, and Arsenal and those teams who have these stadiums and season tickets now are getting up for well beyond £1,000 on average, which is a lot for the, you know, a working class person. So I can imagine there will be fans who will probably say, you know, it's gone a bad way for me, because I can't go to the games in the way that I used to. And that is a great shame. But I just think it's an inevitable byproduct, not just of, foreign supporters and casual supporters, but just generally the way football has gone. So I don't personally harbour any hostility to that. Again, I think we all make jokes about the half and half scarves when we go in to the ground, but I think that's about as far as it goes, you know, going in. But, you know, you want people to go and have a good time. And, I don't think that has to come at the expense, because I don't think they will always, I don't think we'll get to a point where it's all like that. I still think that, you know, the bread and butter of any football team will be the supporters who really live and die for it. And they'll be the people who populate it the most. And I just don't see that changing, because, you know, in Wolverhampton particularly, it's a one city club, and people will find a way to go. It doesn't matter. That's really my take on it. And I don't see that international fans have any kind of duty to do anything other than go and enjoy the game the same as everyone else. So, but, you know, whether I speak for the masses, I don't know. But that's just been my experience. I haven't personally really kind of experienced any hostility. So I hope that would, you know, remain the same.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. I mean, I saw the headline on various socials, and I thought that Ange's answer that he gave was perfect, was absolutely perfect. But I wasn't sure actually what the context was for the original question. Was it hooked around Spurs removing the discount for pensioners' season tickets? I think it was, but if it was, I don't see how that's anyone's fault but the club's. And as Thomas said, I think that sort of thing is becoming increasingly inevitable in a supply and demand market. As for foreign fans, just the concept of foreign fans, I think we've absolutely moved well on from the original dialogue. There's no putting the toothpaste back in the tube really now. And again, where we've arrived at, I think, is a direct through line from Murdoch's partnership to set up the Premier League with Sky in the 1990s to a situation where now most football fans only ever get to watch their team on TV. I'll simplify this story a little bit, just for illustration. When I moved to New York and started going to New York Spurs in 2006, the membership of the club was still primarily Brit expats who were temporary or were living in New York, but you weren't always guaranteed to be able to find your team on TV each weekend. It was actually the number of nights that we ended up just listening to the game on the radio. Kev, the membership started to even out between expats and locals as interest grew among Americans for soccer in general. And I think things like the U.S. men's team performances in the World Cups generated a lot of that interest. And of course, then Spurs signing American players like Brad Friedel and Clint Dempsey had a huge contribution to that interest and that growth. And, you know, by the time I left New York in 2016, the club had comfortably more local members than expats. I mean, the expats probably stayed about the same, but the local interest grew significantly. And the US was then also the biggest growth market, both for the Premier League brand and for individual clubs. And so most of the Spurs, the newly approved Spurs supporters clubs were based in US cities, which you'll notice if you look at the board around around the perimeter of the ground. Anytime we're on TV, you'll see the shout outs to all the supporters club. clubs. And we're actually at the point now where, you know, the Premier League knows where its money's coming from, knows where the expansion is, and they're, every Premier League team's pre-season tours are either, you know, they either alternate between North America and Asia, like year in, year out. And, you know, we've moved on in the discussion. I think fans have the right to come to their home stadium and support their team. You know, if they want to pay the premium required for secondary market tickets, like I know you do, Kev, then so be it. I don't know how that can be restrained. But as a result of that, the dynamic in the stadium on match days inevitably changes. I think the atmosphere and the noise is probably different. But I think that's just something that is part and parcel of the global development of the game. And I think also with Spurs having just moved into the new stadium, which is significantly bigger than the previous one, of course the atmosphere is going to be different. It's going to change from game to game. So this whole argument about, you know, the club needs to be part of the community. I mean, the club is still part of the community. It's just that the community now is the whole world.
Yeah, that's a very nice way to put it, for sure. Also, as you were talking about Hwang Hee-chan, Thomas, obviously the thought occurred that is also part of the discourse within the Spurs fan base, is the amount of Korean fans that go to see Sun Heung-min. Obviously, all the racist stuff is terrible, so everyone just needs to stop with that component of it, for sure. But yeah, it's certainly a fascinating situation outside of that, and as I said, one that I think about a lot as somebody that obviously talks to people that go far more regularly than I'm able to. But yeah, I liked your point, Steve, about it.
Your passion is no less than mine. That's the point. We all come to football and we had come to the team that we support in different ways, but your passion for Spurs is no less than mine.
Very kind of you to say. And as you said, Ange was basically note perfect throughout his response. The only thing I was surprised that he didn't bring up, because he's brought it up in the past, because it was like a core memory with him and his dad, was, just for people that aren't aware, the early matches where I live in Denver are at 5:30 a.m. that's something I just feel like people forget sometimes. They're like, oh, well, they don't, the opposite of what you were just saying, Steve. Oh, well, they can't care as much as me. They aren't from the community, or their father or grandfather wasn't a huge Tottenham fan and they were kind of brought into it through their family. It's like, yeah, well, when I'm setting my alarm at 4:30 a.m., that matters a lot less. but yeah. Anyway, a very, very mild defense.
I'm sorry to go back on it, but there is also something about a sort of a shared suffering.
Oh,
that,
for sure.
You know, we've gone through a really bad period. I mean, for example, my son, who's about your age, Kev, became a fan when we were bad, and then we became good. And he kind of resented people who didn't suffer the way he did. Because I remember one time coming down to the breakfast table and we'd just been knocked out of the, you know, the League Cup by Preston. And he just said, before he went off to school, he said, "Dad, why are we Spurs fans?" And it was like, oh God, I can't answer this right now. But anyway.
Brutal.
There is that sense of shared suffering that I think comes with anything worthwhile.
For sure. And I will say, on the shared suffering point, Thomas, I think we talked about this the last time you were on, with your just, for no reason, dominance of Tottenham lately. I have agreed with my friends that we will not go to early kickoffs against Wolves. The last three, not very fun. We're just not going to do it.
Now you've just argued against yourself.
Well, you know, perhaps I have. We'll go from there into a discussion that we bring up every once in a while about whether or not you want the other Premier League clubs to do well in the European competitions as like a representation of the league or the country or what have you. And usually people just say, meh, not really. That's fine. And that may be your all's response right now. But it is a little bit different now with the coefficient potentially meaning that England could have up to 5 Champions League spots, which would obviously push more spots down through the Europa League and the UEC, the Conference League, that's what that C stands for, as well. And with both of our clubs within touching distance of different European competitions, I just was wanting to ask one more time, are you finding yourselves pulling more for the other English clubs while they're playing their European matches?
I don't know. I think it's on a game by game basis. I think, funnily enough, we were just having a conversation about, you know, outside international fans and their impact on the game. But I think it worked both ways. I think because the game now is more international, more global, we have more awareness of what's going on in the other leagues. I don't necessarily feel as kind of tribal and protective about English clubs. I remember in the 90s when it was like just Man United really were flying the flag in the Champions League. I always wanted Man United to win. You know, it felt like I almost, not like as much as I wanted Wolves to win, but because they were the only team really having a go against, you know, Juventus and Real Madrid and teams like it was, and they couldn't quite get through. You know, they were always banging the drum, always trying to just make it in that competition. So it felt good to see them doing well and representing the Premier League, probably as well because they had a nucleus of English players in that team as well. And I suppose maybe there was some of that. These days, I see it more, you know, I've got more of a awareness for some of the foreign teams, so they don't seem so foreign now, if that makes sense. So, you know, that Arsenal Bayern game, for instance, you know, I don't really have a strong preference who really wins that game. And part of me, and I know you probably agree, there's something just unbelievably delicious about Harry Kane going there and potentially putting Arsenal out. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just too funny to you know, to think about it. So, you know, I'll be watching that game. I mean, that's a superb tie. And I suppose that's kind of how I view it. I just think, well, what a superb game. I mean, Arsenal, fantastic, playing really well. So much control to the way they play. Bayern, not a brilliant Bayern team by all accounts, but they could certainly put it together and do something over the two games. So I suppose if you're just treating that game as an example, I just wouldn't really have a strong pull one way or the other. I'd just be looking forward to a good game of football. But I suppose it does move on to another point, which I know you mentioned, Kev, about does it help more English teams qualify for Europe next season? And could that have a benefit to Wolves, you know, if they can somehow finish around seventh, eighth place in the table and getting them into the competition? So maybe, you know, maybe I'll look back on it at the end of the season, if by some miracle we hang around at this sort of top third of the table and think, oh, maybe I should have been cheering for West Ham against Leverkusen or Arsenal against Bayern, or because whatever knock-on effect. But, you know, in the here and now, I'm just not really bothered. I just want to sit down and watch some of these games and hope that they're good games of football and the team that deserves to get through, you know, does get through. And that's pretty much the long and short of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, to an extent, I'm aware of the coefficient storyline, but to be honest, it hasn't been front and center of how I think about the English teams in Europe. I mean, you know, just my mindset is good luck to them all and let the cards fall where they may, I suppose. I mean, before both of you were born, I assume, there was only one team from each country in the European Cup, and it was noticeable, at least to a sort of a young me starting to follow football, that you cheered for that team. You wanted that team to do well, to prove that, you know, English football was somehow better. And I think, you know, they were the sole representative of your league, and you wanted success in European competitions. And it was a national pride thing, I think, rather than just a club priority. And of course, you know, obviously back then, English teams had very, very few players from outside the UK. So for English fans, it was almost like supporting their national team, I think. And of course, you know, when Spurs and Wolves met in the final of the UEFA Cup in 72, that was, of course, the first time there'd been a European final between two teams from the same country. But then, you know, when the Champions League started, because there weren't enough games on TV and not enough revenue for both broadcasters and clubs, we got to the point where rooting against your rivals to miss out on a Champions League spot actually became a thing, you know. So as I say, I don't think the coefficient is really front of mind for fans of other teams than the ones involved this year. And as we were saying earlier, I think if I'm honest, I can see both Arsenal and West Ham getting past their German opponents. So that can only be a good thing, I think, in the coefficient terms. But I think it does focus your mind on your own team and why they didn't qualify this year. You know what I mean? It's rather than sort of gaze enviously and resentfully at your rivals and hope they get knocked out. You should actually be concentrating more on making sure that your own team does better next season.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And Steve, obviously you've just addressed the two head-to-head matchups, because that's another factor to this that I think is so fascinating. It's just by luck of the draw, there are two English clubs playing two German clubs who are the two that are really fighting to get that fifth spot. Italy is also there, but far enough ahead that they'll probably just get the other extra spot. So yeah, Thomas, of those two matches, do you think this could be a sweep for England like Steve does?
No, I mean, you can't have your back against Leverkusen. Yeah, I mean, I can see a scenario where West Ham win the game, but I think the view going in has got to be that Leverkusen are going to win because they're beating everyone. So if you know, you've got a team that's beating everyone, they're probably going to beat West Ham. I mean, that's just the way it is. I think it would have to be considered a pretty decent upset if West Ham knock them out of their stride. Obviously, the thing is, I don't follow. You know, having said that, you know, I've got more knowledge of the European leagues. I know that Leverkusen are doing well, but I don't really know what, you know, injuries they've got, how they're going to be shaping up on the night in that game, whether Alonso rotates the team, things like that. Don't know how he's going to manage the game, but just looking at their results and how well they're playing, you know, I don't think so. And it really wouldn't surprise me if Bayern accounted for Arsenal. I think maybe why I would give Arsenal the edge is I think one of the words that I used to describe them at the top was control. When I look at Arsenal, I see a bit of the Man City in them, which I think it gives them a bit of... they're a bit different to like Liverpool per se. I feel like Arsenal are controlling a lot of the aspects of the game and the play, and they're more measured in how they pick teams apart. And that's obviously come from the, you know, the Pep school, hasn't it? Because that's Arteta's kind of, you know, following probably a similar model. You know, so I think that they will have a lot of control of that tie, but I think Bayern have just got the firepower to potentially to hurt them. But if I was a betting man, you know, I would probably be just giving Arsenal the edge, but I think certainly I'd expect Leverkusen to beat West Ham.
Gotcha. Well, just in case people are unaware, there's three German clubs left and five English ones. So even if one gets knocked out, that'll help in general, the coefficient. But as we discussed in the overall point, maybe that isn't enough to get people to be rooting for clubs that normally they wouldn't be. But we will leave that there and take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll be discussing club-specific questions with each of our guests.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, and we are back. Thomas, we'll start off with you talking about Wolves. We alluded to it in the first section, but obviously a pretty soul-crushing defeat for Wolves with two injury time goals that you've conceded after having scored in the 88th minute what must have felt like it was surely the winner. So yeah, was just curious your thoughts on the match, what happened there kind of at the end, the result, and if you think it'll have a lasting impact on the squad or morale.
No, I mean, no complaints about the results. You know, congratulations to Coventry City. They definitely deserve the win. They missed a lot of chances. I mean, they should have been a goal up before they were a goal up. And then when they were 1-0 up, they should have been 2-3-0 up before Wolves, you know, turned it round at the end. But obviously, when that second goal goes in for Wolves right at the end, you think, oh, well, that's the narrative of the game. That's going to be the story. It's the championship team. You know, they missed all the chances and then they got beaten by two bits of, you know, quality. I mean, well, it was probably more lucky than the equaliser for Wolves. But, you know, that seemed like was Stoyce. So to the extent where I thought, well, we've won now, you know, I think they're going to press for the equaliser. But I was looking at them thinking, well, they're looking a bit slapdash now. They're rushing it. But, you know, that they got the goals and they fully deserve the win. There's no doubt about that. So that's just the way it is. I mean, we were unlucky. You know, the injuries we've got are all in one area of the pitch. No Neto, no Cunha, no Wang, no Bellegarde. That's four. You know, we had no attacking players, basically. And I thought it was credit to Wolves that they hung in there and Jose Sarr made some brilliant saves. And it looked like we'd performed a miracle, really, with the, you know, the goals we got with Ryan Aitnori, you know, doing superb. He was superb in the game for Wolves. He's a real top talent. I think there's going to be so many teams swarming around him in the summer. He'll definitely be a transfer to watch out for because I think all the top teams could do with a, you know, that left back who can get forward and also do a lot of damage in the final third. He's really matured this season and he's looking a superb player. So, you know, his performance and growth is something we can take from the game. Looking forward, it's pretty miserable for us. I think we're going to really have a tough time down the last 10 games because Pedro Neto looks like he's out for the season now. Wang Ki-chan still a good number of weeks away. So, you know, those players, we don't have the squad to cope with those injuries. So it's kind of any result we get between now and the end is, you know, it's going to be a bit of a bonus, I think. So I think success for us is somehow trying to hold on to a top half finish, you know, and if we can do that, it will be superb. But I think whatever happens from here, even if we end on a bad run, I think we still have to call it a success because, you know, the players have done superbly and Gary O'Neill squeezed every ounce he can out of this squad, I think. And so, you know, it's been a success. But I think we went into that game knowing we just have to do whatever we can to get to the semi-final. And if we can get to Wembley, what a superb season that will have been. So, you know, we just came up short. I think it's going to be really tough for us and, you know, it is what it is. But the good thing is we're not going down. We're going to regroup in the summer. And I think that, you know, that it could be a good season next year if we do the business right in the summer. So I'm very happy from where we were at the start of the season to now. I would have gobbled up this scenario with open arms.
Sure. Yeah. And you'd imagine morale won't be too damaged if you were able to perform like that with that many absences. Obviously Tottenham had a stretch like that this season as well, and you kind of just write it off as that's what happens when you're missing that many key players. Obviously, as you mentioned, a very big one, Pedro Neto, who is himself drawing a lot of attention from other clubs, and I was curious how you're planning on dealing with his absence short term and if you think there's already preparations in case he's gone long term, or if it's one of those weird situations where the injury might see him stay at the club perhaps longer than he may have otherwise.
Well, I mean, I think any of these top clubs, be it Arsenal, Liverpool, even Tottenham, I think have been linked with him. They've got to be looking at him and going, do we want to spend 40, 50 million quid to wrench Pedro Neto out of Wolves? A bloke, he cannot stay fit. You know, he's done his other hamstring this time. So it's not a reoccurrence of his first hamstring injury that took him out for 6 to 8 weeks. This is his other hamstring. I don't know. A part of me is questioning whether he's ever going to be able to sustain enough time on the pitch to be considered a top player, you know. And I think teams are getting a lot savvier now with the money they spend. So for him, I think that could be, you know, kaput for his summer transfer move. I might be wrong, but personally for Wolves now, the way I'm looking at it is, I think if someone wants to pay 50 million plus for him, I think we've got to consider taking it because, you know, my concern would be that this is what it's going to be with him. He's going to be explosive, but he's just not going to be able to sustain it for the long term. So, yeah, I mean, in the short term, as I say, I'm viewing it that we just have to limp home now. We don't have players to come in. Mateus Cunha is going to come back, hopefully after the international break, and that's going to give us a little bit of something. I think Gary O'Neill said that Jean-Rick Nabelgaard may be back soon. They're still assessing the injury he's got. So if we can get him and Cunha playing, and you can, you know, you get a front three of Cunha, Sarabia and Bellegarde, then you've got three pretty decent Premier League footballers there. And, you know, we could do something then, but there's nothing on the bench. I mean, the club made a mistake. You know, we loaned Fabio Silva to Rangers, and Sasa Kalajic sent him to Germany on loan because Gary O'Neill said, well, you know, those players aren't going to get enough minutes for Wolves. But then he obviously didn't anticipate getting four injuries in one area of the pitch. And so that's an example of where they took a bit of a gamble in January when they were trying to get a striker in themselves and they didn't do it. And then they loaned those two players out. And I think everyone was thinking, is that going to come back and bite us? And it has bitten us, to be fair, because we had young Nathan Fraser playing against Coventry. And it's a lot to ask of him. And certainly both of those strikers I mentioned, you know, they would have got game time now had they remained. So I think the club made a miscalculation in January, and that's hurt us. And it's just meant that really now, as I say, we're going to try and cope, but cope is what we're going to be doing. And I think, you know, it's going to be very difficult in the remaining games, starting with a really difficult one at Aston Villa, which, you know, we may talk about if there's time at the end. But tough end, I think, in store. But already, you know, I've got to reiterate, a lot of good things achieved.
Yeah, absolutely fair. And I certainly do hope that you win that match against Aston Villa for very selfish reasons. Steve, we'll come to you next. Obviously, Wolves not the only ones disappointed, perhaps, with their result at the weekend. Coming off what seemed a great match in our own match against Aston Villa, seemed to be a real turning of the corner. Felt as though Tottenham just basically didn't show up in our match against Fulham. Obviously, just your general thoughts on the match, but also, ultimately, were you more dismayed with the way Tottenham performed or failed to, or impressed by what Fulham were doing and how they were able to kind of take advantage of our play style?
Right. No, I think that is a combination of both things. Kev, my thought when Fulham scored their fourth before it was wiped off by VAR was just that the contrast in back-to-back games with a 4-0 outcome for and against could hardly be more Spursy. The idea that we couldn't build on something from last week. And of course, then it came on the one-year anniversary of Conte's, you know, infamous rant about the club as well. I mean, nobody came away from that performance with any credit yesterday. And the Vicario, but the inconsistency. Maybe. Who, sorry?
Vicario.
Oh, yeah. Well, he rises above every week, really, doesn't he? And a lot of things are not within his control. But just the inconsistency through the team of going from the Villa game to that performance, it shows that, you know, for all the good that Ange has done, there are still many, many things to be fixed, some of which he can control and some of which he can't. But no one played to their capacity. And I think there was a general sense that they admitted that afterwards. Certainly Sonny did. And of course we missed Van de Ven as well, but it was a disappointing performance from top to bottom. It was a tough game for Dragosin to get his first start. But of course, you know, the fickle nature of Spurs social media only amplifies it. I mean, we're not going to sack the guy on the strength of one game, obviously, but he has to show that he's learning from setbacks. And we're so far into the season now that, you know, we've had several setbacks, and it's not really clear that he is taking on board why something didn't work. I mean, I don't think any of us mentioned the Conte thing. I don't think any of us want to go back to how things were the past couple of seasons. And we knew this year would be an intense learning curve. But, you know, credit to Fulham, absolutely, for outplaying us at our own game. It felt, I think, like a combination of them playing above themselves and having a good game plan, and maybe us heading into the game with some complacency, especially after playing so well the previous week. I mean, this was the first time since Ange arrived that we hadn't scored in a game. And that, I think that was probably a fair reflection. And it was also, I think, the fifth straight game that we hadn't scored in the first half. But then over that stretch of games, we'd scored 10 in the second halves. So, you know, as always, though, we move on to whatever's next. But there were a lot of things that we need to be aware of. And I hate to go back to the old psychological thing, but there was a sense that when we when they scored their third goal, you could tell that the body language on the pitch was not good, that we weren't going to, you know, knuckle down and try to get to this. But, you know, we move on to whatever's next. So, yeah, disappointing.
Yeah, certainly. and sorry, I got something in my throat right as I was segueing to you, and it has not gone away. Yeah, certainly agree with a lot of those points. There's also been a thing that I've noticed, I don't know if you have as well, where it's starting to feel like our midfield is doing nothing for large stretches of the match, where maybe they're collecting the ball from the defense and then trying to move it forward, but not really. And that the only time we're able to do anything is once the ball gets out wide to either Poro or Udogi, or we play a diagonal, which we don't do nearly as much as we used to, of course, but it still happens at times, to Brennan or Kulusevski. Who have obviously started the last two matches. I was just curious if you'd picked up on that or if it's a concern that you have that we're playing three midfielders every match in the place where we can't operate very well as the midfield.
Right. No, those are good points, actually. And I think, but that's the contrast that I was talking about with last week. I mean, we were moving the ball really well through the transition, through the midfield last week, and, you know, being able to use Udogi and Poro on the wings. I mean, the thing with Bentancur versus Bissouma, I don't know whether how Ange actually ranks the importance of who we're playing against, if you know what I mean. It's just, you know, here's who I've got fit, here's who I've got available. And I know he wants to encourage Bissouma and Saar to play together, but I mean, Bentancur, when he comes on, seems to have taken on this role that was reserved for Romero, of a guaranteed yellow card. He seems to be picking up a lot of yellow cards recently, but he's still, you know, head and shoulders one of our best players, and I don't know why. Again, the other thing was yesterday the substitutions were late again. Ange is really stubborn when it comes to changing things up and making changes, especially in the midfield. So, I think you're right. And I think also, again, credit to Fulham, because they obviously had a game plan and they obviously knew how we played. They'd obviously watched the video from our game against Villa, and they made sure that we weren't able to replicate that. So, yeah, it was frustrating, but it was also, as I say, we have to learn from these setbacks, and I'm not sure we are sufficiently.
Yeah, and then one final question for you. You mentioned Van de Ven's absence. Obviously, he is probably one of our best passers in the back line, and then also the one that does all the recovery defense, which is why we've already seen two hamstring injuries from him, unless you think it's just you, Thomas, with Pedro Neto. what do you think, there's something we can do to somehow, in a secondary way, replace him that isn't just putting another center back there? Or is it really just a situation of anytime Van de Ven's out, we're inherently going to struggle more?
Yeah, I don't know. And this is the interesting thing. When Ange said last week that they were looking at another center back for the end of the season to bring another center back in. And I don't think that was any reflection on how well or badly Dragosin was doing in training, for example. I don't think there was a sense that, you know, hey, we've got this guy, but we need somebody else. I think it really is, as you say, trying to take as much weight off Romero and Van de Ven, and especially Mickey, as we possibly can. I'm not sure he knows any other way to play, though. I mean, he's literally, you know, comes on at 50 miles an hour, and that's how he runs every game. So he's so central to our recovery and our defending, especially when an attack breaks down and we have to track back. And we're lucky, as I say, we're lucky that we have Udogi and Poro, who can actually make those sorts of runs back and cover. But Van de Ven has turned out to be absolutely indispensable when it comes to how we organize the defense and then the transition to the midfield. But I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Do you think Ange has another center back in mind, a specific player who could share that load?
That's a great question. And what's really fascinating about all this to me is I wanted Tapsoba over Van de Ven in the summer, but I didn't realize that one of the requirements was be the fastest center back in the world, which Vondervan just happens to be, while also being like 6'4" or something ridiculous. So you'd imagine it's just another just really pacey center back, and then you're just trusting everyone else to handle the rest of the defensive duties. I think if you're trying to figure out the profile for another center back we need to sign, obviously for the defensive recovery, you need someone that's very fast. But also, our back line is pretty terrible at heading the ball, which is going to cost us in other matches. So now it's like, okay, let's get someone that's tall, really good in the air, also blisteringly fast, and also one of the best passers at that position. I'm not exactly sure that person exists. If they are, I'm sure they'd cost quite a bit of money. But I don't know. I think a potential solution would be if you got a very fast defensive-minded left back. And then if you're without Van de Ven, instead of sticking with Udogie and Poro, who I love both for sure, but they're always attacking so much that it puts extra pressure on Van de Ven to save everything. And maybe then if you have a naturally left-sided center back, which Dragushin is not, if you have a naturally left-sided center back that can at least do the passing, maybe he's good in the air, and then you have a pacier left back that's also willing to track back the whole way, maybe doesn't bomb forward and you do something else in attack to replace that, maybe that's how you can fudge it without having to have this like singular player that's good at everything.
You mean like Ben Davies 8 years ago?
Yeah. Not a bad shout, but maybe even faster. Kyle Walker's speed plus Ben Davies 8 years ago. Maybe that's a way around it. I don't know tactically how you solve this issue other than just playing a more defensive style, which he's very loudly said he'll never do. So changes.
Just following on from that, I think what you said is actually really interesting because this is going to be the crucial. I mean, we say this every year, but this is the crucial transfer window for Ange to try and make, stamp his identity on the team that he wants to put out. And it's pretty much 75% of the way there. I think he just needs to make sure that that who we're targeting, who we're looking for, fits into the way he wants to play.
Yep, agreed. And we'll obviously see how that summer goes and which positions we want to target, because I feel like there's a lot of positions where we're pretty good but not great, and then positions that obviously need drastic improvement. So time will tell, and I suppose this conversation does lend a little more context to the opening one where we were discussing the match, where We are not a finished product by any stretch, and hopefully we can take a step towards that in the summer. Okay, cool. We'll wrap up now with Player Watch, where I was wondering who you think will score the most goals for your club between now and the end of the season.
Well, I know you're trolling me with this, Kev, because I've just said that all of our strikers are out, so you knew this was a comedy question to ask. But I don't know. I mean, I suppose... hopefully Mateus Cunha, because he's the only one. He should be back for the next game, and he looked very good before the injury. So probably Mateus Cunha. I'm trying to think who else it could be. Sarabia isn't really getting many goals. He's getting the assists. Ryan Aitnori's got 2 goals in his last two, and he's sort of playing more advanced. So, yeah, maybe some goals from there. Mario Lemina has got a habit of getting on the end of things, but... We just got to hope that Mateus Cunha can come back and carry us on his shoulders a little bit, I think, to the finish line. So, barring someone else coming out of the shadows, I think. I mean, to be fair to Wolves, it has been a team effort with the goals. Really, it's been shared around a decent amount between the midfielders and the attackers. So, probably we're hoping Mateus Cunha is going to come back and get maybe another 5 or 6 between now and the end of the season to win us a couple of games and hopefully maybe keep us in the top half.
The way we are at the moment, it'll probably be Son primarily because he's a guaranteed starter in every game. But the refreshing thing has been that we're getting contributions from plenty of players. We're not just the Kane and Son show again as we were last season, but among the others in our so-called front three, or rather any two from four alongside Son, Richarlison was on a pretty solid run recently, while, you know, mostly coming off the bench, while Kulusevski and Johnson, you'd expect more to show up more steadily in the goal involvements category, even if their totals are less than the other two. But then the good thing this season is we're getting goals and assists from Madison, from Saar, from the midfield, and Romero at the back. So, for example, the burden is being shared all across the pitch, which has been great to see, I think. And especially as we were talking about in the previous question, the attacking assists that come from Porro and Udogie helping set up the others. So it's a really good spread, I think, and it bodes well for the future. I mentioned Harry Kane, that we're not the Kane and Son show, and you know, it was good to see Harry breaking another couple of Bundesliga records this week for Bayern. He now has the most hat tricks in a season in Bundesliga history, and the most goals in a debut season, you know, as well as setting his own personal season high with 31. But the way Spurs set up last season and now, I think in a way Harry had to leave to allow greater responsibility for goals and involvement and greater collaborative play all across the team. And I think Ange has tapped into that. So, yeah, I think in terms of goals per minute on the pitch, it'll probably still be Son, but we're lucky to have it spread across the whole team.
Yep, definitely agree with that. And we will wrap there. So if you'd like to tell folks where they can find you or anything you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, guys. As always, you can log on to wolvesblog.com to see the latest stuff. We're going to have previews and match reports, all the games. There's obviously the fallout from the Coventry game on there at the moment, and there'll be a preview going up for the Aston Villa game. And as it's the international break, probably a think piece on Wolves, possibly on summer transfer activity, what Pedro Neto might be doing, and a couple of the other players who are probably going to be having admiring glances thrown their way by some of the top teams. So yeah, there'll be some pieces on there and some discussion. So if you're interested in that, your team's playing Wolves or you support Wolves, log on and join in. You know, anyone can comment. So it'd be good to chat with you. But until next time, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, Kev. I much appreciate it. And thank you, Thomas. Another good conversation. If you want to follow New York Spurs, you can get them on Twitter, X at New York Spurs. If you want to follow my non-football writing, you can get me at statesofplayproject.com. And finally, I have to mention this, if you don't mind. If you've ever been to a game at St. James's Park, you'll know how important Newcastle's use of the Mark Knopfler song Going Home is. This week, Knopfler just released a new version of that with like 50 of the world's greatest guitar players playing on it with him. And it's to benefit the Teenage Cancer Trust in the UK and Teen Cancer America. So if you know the song, if you know what it means to the people in Newcastle, seek it out and download it.
Yep, good call out there. I'm your host, Kevin DeBreeze. You can find the show at EPL Roundtable. You can find me at Kevroff. And of course, you can just search EPL Roundtable on any of your podcast services, although it seems that you've nailed it if you've made it this long into the show. But yeah, massive thanks to Thomas and Steve again for joining me. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.